A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel read something I said in a past episode, that the standing army is a relatively new idea, and he's not buying it. His pushback is Rome. If you've got soldiers almost continuously at war, expanding an empire year after year, doesn't that require a group of people who do this full-time, all year? And if Rome had that, then how new can the standing army really be? He's asking us to untangle the definition from the reality. And honestly, the definition does most of the work here.
It really does. Because the phrase standing army sounds like it should just mean any military force that's always around, but the technical definition is narrower than that, and it's the narrowness that makes the claim true. A standing army is a permanent professional force maintained even in peacetime. The even in peacetime part is the whole thing. It's soldiers whose full-time job is military readiness, not farmers who fight during the growing season and go home after harvest, not temporary levies raised for a specific war and disbanded the moment it's over.
So the opposite isn't no army. It's an army that exists only when there's a war to fight.
Exactly that. And for most of human history, that's what everyone had. You raised a force for a campaign, you fought the campaign, you sent everyone home. The Roman Republic's legions, and this is the part that trips people up, were raised annually by the Senate and disbanded after each campaign season. Every year was essentially a new army. Polybius describes the system in detail in the 2nd century BCE. The consuls would announce the levy. Citizens would assemble on the Capitoline Hill. Tribunes would select men by lot, and they'd swear an oath for that year's campaign. Then harvest comes, war's over, everyone goes back to their farms.
So Daniel's instinct is right, that Rome was almost continuously at war, but wrong that this required a standing army. They fought constantly with a rotating cast.
That's the key distinction. Professional soldiers aren't the same thing as a standing army. You can have a society where warfare is constant and the people doing it are highly skilled, but the institution itself is temporary and recreated from scratch each time. The Roman Republic ran that system for centuries. Soldiers had to be property-owning citizens, the ad situi, because you provided your own equipment. If you couldn't afford a sword and shield, you weren't in the army. That automatically meant the fighting class was farmers and landowners who had something to go back to.
Which also meant there was a built-in limit on how long you could campaign. You can't stay in the field through November if your olive trees need harvesting.
Right, and that seasonal rhythm is completely different from a standing army. A standing army doesn't care about the harvest. Its soldiers are paid year-round and the state feeds them. That model doesn't show up in Rome until the Marian reforms in 1007 BCE, and even then it's not quite what we'd recognize.
Walk me through Marius. What actually changed?
So, by the late 2nd century BCE, Rome's been fighting longer and further from home. Spain, North Africa, Greece, Asia Minor. The old citizen militia model is cracking because you can't run a multi-year campaign in Spain with farmers who need to get back to Latium. Marius, who's consul, opens recruitment to the capite sensi, the headcount, the landless poor who'd never been eligible before. The state provides their equipment. They sign up for 16 years, later extended to 25. Suddenly you've got a professional volunteer class whose career is soldiering.
That sounds like a standing army to me.
It's close, and a lot of historians call it the birth of the professional Roman army, but it still lacks the peacetime maintenance structure. These soldiers are paid during campaigns. Between wars, they're discharged. There's no permanent institution that keeps them training and ready when there's no fighting. They're more like a standing pool of veterans you can recall than a standing army and garrison.
So the state isn't paying them to sit around sharpening swords in peacetime?
Correct. The real shift comes under Augustus. After Actium in 31 BCE, he's got something like 50 legions, way too many and way too expensive. He demobilizes about half, settles veterans in colonies, and keeps 28 legions as permanent units stationed in provinces, about 150,000 men, year-round, in fixed bases. This is 14 CE. They're not disbanded after a campaign season. They stay.
Now that's a standing army.
It looks like one, and a lot of textbooks will tell you the Roman Empire had a standing army. But there are structural differences from the modern model that matter. First, there's no central barrack system. Legions are spread across provinces, building forts and roads when they're not fighting. Second, and this is the big one, the force is tied to the emperor's personal command, not to a state institution. The soldiers swear an oath to the emperor personally. When the emperor can't pay them, the system collapses, not because the state ran out of money, but because the personal patron-soldier relationship broke.
That personal versus institutional distinction feels important. A modern standing army is loyal to the Constitution or the state, not to the president as a person.
That's exactly the difference. In a modern standing army, if the head of state dies, the army doesn't dissolve. The institution continues. In Rome, if the emperor lost legitimacy or couldn't pay, the legions would just switch commanders, or march on Rome and install a new one. The year of the four emperors in 69 CE is basically four different legionary factions deciding their guys should be in charge. That's not a state army. That's four private armies wearing the same uniform.
So Rome had professional soldiers, permanent units, year-round deployment, but not a standing army in the institutional sense. The continuity was personal, not structural.
Right, and that's why the claim that standing armies are new holds up under scrutiny. The thing we mean by standing army, a permanent, state-sustained, institutionally continuous force maintained in peacetime, regardless of who's in charge, doesn't appear in Europe until the 15th century. France's Compagnies d'Ordonnance, 1445. Charles VII creates 15 companies of 100 lances each, paid year-round even when there's no war. That's the first one in Western Europe since Rome, and arguably the first one that fits the modern definition.
What's a lance in this context?
Not a weapon, it's a unit. A lance forney is a team built around a knight, the man-at-arms himself, a lighter cavalryman, a page, and two or three archers. So 100 lances is maybe 500 or 600 men. 15 companies is around 8,000 or 9,000 troops, standing, paid, year-round.
That's tiny by Roman standards. Augustus had 150,000.
And that's the medieval gap in a nutshell. After Rome falls, Europe reverts to feudal levies for about 1,000 years. Knights owe 40 days of service per year. Peasants form local militias for defense. There's no permanent force anywhere. The king's army is just a collection of nobles who show up when summoned, and they leave after their 40 days are up, whether the campaign's finished or not. It's a terrible system for actually winning wars, which is why the Crusades kept running into logistical walls. Your army literally expires on you mid-siege.
40 days. That's barely enough to get anywhere.
It's designed for local defense, not expeditionary warfare. And that's the baseline that makes the standing army seem revolutionary when it finally arrives. Charles VII isn't just creating a military unit. He's creating the idea that the state should maintain armed men even when nobody's attacking. It's politically explosive. The English Parliament spends the entire 17th century fighting with the king about whether he's allowed to have a standing army because they see it as the tool of tyranny. The 1689 Bill of Rights declares that raising or keeping a standing army within the kingdom in time of peace is against law.
Wait, the English Bill of Rights explicitly bans standing armies?
In peacetime, without Parliament's consent. That's how threatening the idea was. A standing army wasn't seen as national defense. It was seen as the king's private enforcement squad. The whole reason the Second Amendment exists in the U.S. Constitution is this exact English debate. The militia versus standing army tension was still live in the 1780s.
So the thing we now think of is completely normal. A country having a military that just exists all the time was considered a threat to liberty for most of its history.
And the numbers bear out how recent the normalization is. Louis XIV's army hits 400,000 by 1700, the largest in Europe. Centralized command, uniform training, year-round pay. That's the first truly modern standing army by any definition, but it's also a monarch's personal force. The shift to a national standing army, the army as an instrument of the people rather than the crown, doesn't happen until the French Revolution.
The levée en masse.
1793. 800,000 conscripts in a single year. That's more soldiers than Louis XIV had at his peak, raised in 12 months from a population of about 28 million. It's not a standing army in the traditional sense. It's a temporary citizen army, raised for a specific existential crisis. but it introduces the idea that the nation itself, not the king, is what you're fighting for, and that every citizen has a military obligation. That idea sticks.
And that's where modern conscription models come from. The notion that the army is the citizenry in arms, not a separate professional class.
Right. And here's the interesting thing. The conscription model is actually closer in spirit to the Roman Republic than to Louis XIV's standing army. The Republic's citizen militia was exactly that, citizens who trained, fought, and returned to civilian life. The standing professional army was the aberration. Mass conscription brings back the older pattern, just with better organization.
So Daniel's question about Rome was pointing at something real. The Roman model, citizens serving in rotation, a small professional corps surrounded by a larger temporary force, that's not a million miles from what Israel does today.
It's really not. Israel's standing army is about 50,000. That's the professional corps, the officers and specialists who are career military. Then you've got mandatory conscription, 2 to 3 years for men and women, producing a conscript base that cycles through continuously. And then the reserve pool, about 400,000 citizens who train annually and can be mobilized in hours. Reservists serve until age 40, 45 for officers. The standing corps is just the scaffolding. The actual fighting force, if you need it, is the citizenry.
That's the Republican model with better record keeping.
Laughs. That's one way to put it. But the comparison is useful because it shows how the standing army isn't the end point of military evolution. It's one model among several, and it's historically quite unusual. Most societies, including Rome for most of its history, use some version of small permanent corps plus large temporary levy. The idea that you'd maintain hundreds of thousands of soldiers in peacetime, just in case, is a 17th century European invention that only became standard because European states kept fighting each other.
And even then, as we'll probably hear from Hilbert later, the standing part was often more aspirational than real.
I suspect you're right. But before we get there, let me fill in the Prussian piece, because it's the missing link between the levée en masse and modern reserve systems. After Napoleon crushes Prussia in 1806, the Treaty of Tilsit limits the Prussian army to 42,000 men. So the Prussians invent the Krumper system. They train 42,000 men annually, but rotate them through quickly, so that over a few years you've got a huge pool of trained civilians who can be called up. By 1813, that pool is something like 120,000 men who've done military training but aren't on the books as active soldiers.
They gained the treaty by treating the army as a training pipeline rather than a standing force.
And created the modern reserve model in the process. Every system where you do 18 months of national service and then you're in the reserves for a decade, that traces back to the Krumper system. The standing army becomes a school, not a garrison. The real military is the population.
Which brings us to the modern landscape. You've got a few different models operating right now. The US and UK. Small professional standing army, all volunteer, no conscription, backed by reserves. South Korea. Large standing army, about 500,000, plus conscription. Switzerland, tiny standing force, universal militia service, and they keep their rifles at home.
The Swiss model is the one that most puzzles outsiders. Every Swiss man does military service, and after basic training, you literally take your assault rifle home and store it in your house. The idea is that the army is the people. There's no separate military caste living in barracks. It's the most direct descendant of the citizen militia tradition, and it's also the hardest to square with the standing army concept, because there's almost no standing component at all.
And then there's the direction things might be heading. If the standing army is only 500 years old, and already fragmenting into hybrid models, corps plus reserves, cyber components, drone forces that aren't really standing in any traditional sense, the definition itself is getting unstable.
The drone thing is interesting because it breaks the personnel model entirely. A standing army is defined by people, soldiers who are paid to be ready. But if your primary strike capability is a fleet of drones operated by civilians working shifts from an office park, is that a standing army? It's a standing capability, but the operators might be contractors who go home at 5. The category starts to dissolve.
And cyber forces are even weirder. The US Cyber Command has about 6,000 personnel. But they're not standing in a field. They're at keyboards. The readiness is continuous by definition. There's no peacetime for cyber. So you've got a force that's permanently deployed, permanently engaged, but doesn't look anything like a standing army of the Louis XIV variety.
Which is why I think Daniel's question lands at exactly the right moment. He's pushing back on a claim that sounds too neat. Standing armies are new, and the answer is yes, but the history is messier than the claim suggests. Rome had professional soldiers without a standing army. Medieval Europe had neither. The early modern period invented the standing army, but even then it was often a fiction on paper. And now we're watching it evolve into something else in real time.
Let's talk about that fiction on paper part, because I think that's where things get interesting. You mentioned the British army in the Napoleonic period.
The numbers are striking. In 1803, the British army has about 50,000 regulars on the books. By 1813, it's 250,000. But most of that expansion isn't the standing army growing. It's militia, volunteers, and foreign troops raised specifically for the war against Napoleon. The standing corps was tiny. And here's the detail that I think Hilbert might have thoughts on. Even the permanent regiments in 1800 were mostly under strength. Some had 200 men on paper and 40 in reality.
40. So the regiment exists as a name and a headquarters, but the actual soldiers aren't there.
And this was completely normal. The standing army was maintained as a skeleton, a framework of officers, a few veteran NCOs, the regimental colors, the institutional knowledge, and in wartime you'd fill it out with new recruits. The standing part was the organization, not the personnel. The men came and went.
That sounds less like a standing army and more like a standing bureaucracy with a military mailing list.
Laughs. Which is maybe the most honest description of what a modern defense ministry actually is. But it gets at something important. The standing army has always been more idea than reality. The ideal is a force that's fully manned, fully equipped, and ready to fight at all times. The reality is usually a cadre that can expand. And that's not a failure of the model. It's the model working as designed. You don't pay for 400,000 soldiers in peacetime because you don't need 400,000 soldiers in peacetime. You need the ability to generate them quickly when you do.
The standing army was never really standing. It was always a shell that gets filled in a crisis, which means Daniel's original skepticism. Wait, hasn't this always existed in some form? Has a point. The thing we call a standing army is a specific 17th century European institutional innovation, but the underlying pattern, a small permanent military establishment that expands dramatically in wartime, is much older.
That's where I think we should bring Hilbert in, because I know he's got experience with exactly this question from the archival side, what the paperwork reveals about how standing these forces actually were.
I've been wondering when he'd jump in. He's been quiet.
Not quiet. Waiting. You two have been talking about the British Army on paper, and I've been sitting here thinking about the actual paper. The muster rolls? I spent most of 2001 digitizing Napoleonic-era personnel records for the Ministry of Defense. Civilian contractor. 6-month project that turned into 14 because the archive was twice the size anyone thought. Room full of ledgers from 1803 to 1815. Every soldier who passed through a regiment, when they enlisted, when they were paid, when they deserted, when they died.
What did the rolls actually show?
That the standing army was a magic trick. You'd open a muster roll for a regiment that was supposed to have 800 men, and the first 40 pages would be names, ranks, pay rates, and then you'd get to the effectives column, and the number would be 312. And that was a good month. Some regiments were running at 40% of paper strength for years. The army knew this. The war office knew this. They kept the regiments on the books at full strength for prestige and for budget. Parliament allocates money per regiment, not per actual soldier, but the men weren't there.
The money kept flowing for soldiers who didn't exist.
The colonel pocketed the difference. That was the system. You bought your colonelcy, literally purchased the commission to command a regiment, and then you drew pay for 800 men and provided 400. Nobody audited it because nobody wanted to know. The army looked big on the budget and small on the ground, and that suited everyone until a war started, and suddenly you needed the other 400 men, and they weren't trained, didn't exist, and had to be raised from scratch.
Which is exactly what happened in the run-up to Waterloo.
1803, 50,000 regulars. 1813, 250,000. But the 50,000 were real-ish, mostly real, some ghost soldiers, but a core. The additional 200,000 were militia units raised for the emergency, foreign troops hired from German states, volunteers who signed up for the duration. After Waterloo, they were all discharged within 2 years. By 1817, the army was back down to about 90,000, and even that was probably inflated.
The standing army of the Napoleonic period was about 50,000 actual soldiers, plus a budgeting fiction, plus a temporary mass levy that vanished the moment the war ended.
The fiction was the point. The British state wanted to be seen as having a standing army. It was a mark of being a serious power, but didn't want to pay for one. So they maintained the appearance and hoped nobody would check the muster rolls. I checked the muster rolls for 14 months.
What was the worst regiment you found?
The 14th Foot. On paper, 1,200 men in 1807. Actual effectives in the field, just under 200. The rest were listed as sick, detached, on furlough, or just blank. Blank meant deserted, but nobody wanted to write deserted because that would require paperwork. Easier to leave the line empty and hope the war ended before anyone asked.
200 out of 1,200. That's not a regiment. That's a company with delusions of grandeur.
They still called it the 14th Foot and marched it around like it was a full formation. The name mattered more than the men. That's the thing about standing armies. They're standing in name long before they're standing in fact. The institution exists before the soldiers do.
That actually connects back to something we were saying earlier about Rome. The legions under Augustus had unit names and standards that persisted for centuries. The Legio Ex Fratensis was still around in the 4th century CE, but the actual men cycled through constantly. The continuity was the name, the eagle, the institutional identity. The soldiers were replaceable.
Same thing in the British Army. The regimental system is designed for that. The regiment never dies. It gets amalgamated, merged, renamed, but the lineage continues. The men are temporary. The regiment is forever. That's the standing part. Not the soldiers.
The standing army is really a standing name with a budget attached, and the soldiers show up when needed.
That's been true more often than not. Even today. How many NATO countries actually maintain their paper strength? The Germans have been struggling with recruitment for years. The British army's below target. Everyone's got units on the books that aren't fully manned. The standing army is always partly aspirational.
Which makes Daniel's question even sharper. He asked whether standing armies are really new, and the answer depends on what you mean by standing. If you mean the institutional framework, the names, the budgets, the permanent headquarters, that's relatively new, about 500 years in Europe. If you mean the actual soldiers being permanently under arms, that's been intermittent at best, and often a fiction.
The fiction is what I'd underline. I spent 14 months in a basement in Kew reading ledgers that proved the British Army was a ghost for most of the Napoleonic Wars. And they won. So maybe the standing army isn't the thing that wins wars. Maybe it's the ability to stop being a ghost when it matters.
That's a good place to land. The standing army is a specific institutional invention. 15th century France, 17th century standardization, 19th century mass conscription. But it's never been as solid as the name suggests. Rome had the fighting men without the institution. Modern states had the institution without always having the men, and the models are still shifting.
One thing I wanted to mention that we didn't get to, the Persian immortals. They're often cited as an ancient standing army, 10,000 strong, always kept at exactly that number because replacements were ready the moment someone fell. But they were a palace guard, not a national military. They protected the king, not the state. The distinction matters because it's the same pattern we saw everywhere. Permanent forces existed, but they were personal retinues, not institutions of state.
The Spartan army, full-time warriors, but only because they had a slave class doing all the actual work. That's not a standing army. That's a leisure class with spears.
Right. The model doesn't scale unless you've got a helot population underneath, which is why no one copied it.
Where does this leave us? Standing armies are 500 years old and already evolving into something else. Smaller professional corps, larger reserves, cyber and drone components that don't fit the old definitions. The thing Daniel was questioning turns out to be real, but also kind of a moving target.
I think the open question is whether the standing army survives the next 50 years in any recognizable form. If the trend is towards smaller permanent forces and larger mobilizable pools, which is what Israel does, what Switzerland does, what the Krumper system did, then maybe the standing army was a historical blip. A 200-year experiment in keeping large numbers of men under arms in peacetime, enabled by the Industrial Revolution's capacity to feed and pay them, now winding down as technology changes the math.
Daniel's instinct was right to push back. The history is messier than standing armies anew. Rome had the pieces, but not the institution. Early modern Europe built the institution, but often couldn't fill it. And today the institution is mutating into hybrid forms that might make the term obsolete. The standing army was never quite what it claimed to be.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, who's actually read the muster rolls and can confirm the ghost soldiers were real, or rather, not real, which was the point.
If you want more episodes on military history, organizational design, or the weird prompts that send us down these rabbit holes, visit myweirdprompts.com or find us on Spotify.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, Q.